Christianity for modern pagans. We continue in this very large enclave. Page 123 is where we left off. And we're too far in to reread up to this point, so we're just going to have to jump in from the cliff, as it were, and try to recollect ourselves as we go along. You'll recall that this chapter is called Lost in the Cosmos, and at least a sizable portion of this essay has been marveling in the paradoxes of the smallness and greatness of man, the vastness of the universe, but also its lack of intelligence, and kind of a deep essay in terms of reflecting on anthropology, what it is to be a human being. And of course, what's in the background is that we can only begin to know ourselves as we begin to know God. And in many respects, maybe we can only know ourselves relative to other persons and ultimately relative to God. So these have been the ideas here before. The enemy has been scientism, which has grossly distorted everything, like every man is the measure of all things, dismissing God, demythologizing the universe, taking what once were the rich and glorious heavens, a kind of
revelation and communication of God, and transforming them into empty, meaningless, chance-laden space. So these are the things that we are considering in this Ponce. We'll open with our invocation prayer, and then, like I said, we'll just jump back in on page 123. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right. Very last paragraph on 123. Pascal writes, "We naturally believe we are more capable of reaching the center of things than of embracing their circumference, and the visible extent of the world is visibly greater than we. But since we, in our turn, are greater than small things, we think we are more capable of mastering them. And yet it takes no less capacity to reach nothingness than the whole. In either case, it takes an infinite capacity, and it seems to me that anyone who had understood the ultimate principles of things might also succeed in knowing infinity. One depends on the other, and one leads to the other. These extremes touch and join by going in opposite directions, and they meet in God and God alone." All right, so keep a finger here on this page, and let's flip forward to O on 132. Here Kraft writes, "God is infinitely great and infinitely small, greater than the universe and smaller than the atom, containing the universe and contained by each atom, transcendent and immanent, outside and inside, the circumference that is nowhere and the center that is everywhere." Pascal probably got this point from Nicholas of Cusa. Right, so these have to do with speculations regarding God via natural revelation and the use of reason. While we're here, we've got short comments on P and Q, so we'll test ourselves here. We'll just grab those comments and then see if we can remember them when we hit P and Q. So P, I have had A students in logic who could understand everything except the indubitability of the law of non-contradiction. So I don't know if that is a typo there with that A. I assume it is. But you can see his point that the law of non-contradiction sometimes is hard for us, especially as moderns, to grasp. And then cue the dilemma of skepticism and dogmatism, which, of course, you recall this. By dogmatism, he means like absolute certitude, so the kind of thing that Descartes was after. And skepticism would be like, I mean, everything after Descartes, especially Hume, and the idea that dogmatism can't survive skepticism, and then skepticism can't survive itself. So the dilemma of skepticism and dogmatism is now better understood in the more universal perspective of our magnetic repulsion from extremes. Okay, so we'll jump back in. That takes us back to page 124. Let us then realize our limitations. We are something, and we are not everything. Such being as we have conceals from us the knowledge of first principles, which arise from nothingness, and the smallness of our being hides infinity from our sight. Our intelligence occupies the same rank in the order of intellect as our body in the whole range of nature. Limited in every respect, we find this intermediate state between two extremes reflected in all our faculties. Our senses can perceive nothing extreme. Too much noise deafens us, too much light dazzles. When we are too far or too close, we cannot see properly. An argument is obscured by being too long or too short. Too much truth bewilders us. I know people who cannot understand that 4 from 0 leaves 0. First principles are too obvious for us. Too much pleasure causes discomfort. Too much harmony in music is displeasing. Too much kindness annoys us. We feel neither extreme heat nor extreme cold. Qualities carried to excess are bad for us and cannot be perceived. We no longer feel them. We suffer them. Excessive youth and excessive age impair thought. So do too much and too little learning. In a word, extremes are as if they did not exist for us, nor we for them. They escape us, or we escape them. All right, and this is, in a sense, perfectly in keeping heretofore with the vanity of the philosophers and the vanity of dogmatism, the two previous chapters, where we have to recognize that neither are we neutral nor are we capable of the extremes. And so that, in and of itself, sets a great limitation on the use and ability of our reason or other senses to determine the truth about the universe. So just the fact that we are created the way we are, and even considered apart from the deformation of sin, we have these kind of innate limitations. So man without God then is going to necessarily be bound to his creatureliness, nothing more and nothing less. Okay, let's see if we can pick back up last paragraph on 124. Such is our true state. That is what makes us incapable of certain knowledge or absolute ignorance. We are floating in a medium of vast extent, always drifting uncertainly, blown to and fro. Whenever we think we have a fixed point to which we can cling and make fast, it shifts and leaves us behind. If we follow it, it eludes our grasp, slips away, and flees eternally before us. Nothing stands still for us. Okay, so obviously this is an important point in this paragraph, maybe especially, that we are incapable of both certain knowledge, so absolute certainty, like that which Descartes was after and that which obviously theologians are after, But then we are also equally incapable of absolute ignorance. So we would almost rather be more comfortable in one or the other. The world is all completely nonsense. It's all material. My consciousness is a hallucination. My perception's a hallucination. There's no sense to be made of anything. But no one actually lives that way. Or this desire to be absolutely certain about things, but then the inability to remain certain of those things in a philosophically satisfying way. Okay, so it makes man a middling creature. It makes man as a creature, obviously with certain limitations, but then if he is to transcend any of this, the only answer will be in God. So you can kind of tell what's dancing in the background there. All right, we just hit comment R, so let's go to 133 and grab this comment from Kraft. Okay, so he says, perhaps this is one of the many deep reasons why we are so wrapped and arrested by the sea, especially its restless waves. In it, we meet ourselves. We are land creatures in a world that seems all sea. We are the dove that Noah let out of his ark. It found no land to rest on and came flying back. We have feet, but no place to put them down. We are like foxes living among fish, finding no lair. We need land. We need a stable center, an absolute by which we can measure the relative. But in this universe, we have found everything is relative. Copernicus told us we were not the center. Pascal tells us the universe's circumference is everywhere and the center is nowhere. Soon Einstein would tell us that space and time itself were relative. Ancient tribes often drove their holy temple tent pole into a hole they labeled the navel of the earth, and declared, like Bostonians, that this was the hub of the universe. We have lost that hole. If our spiritual tent pole had remained stuck into God, Copernicus' physical decentrification would not have mattered much. Well, and even in the end analysis might not even be true, just in a more dynamic way. Nor would anyone have made the foolish but common mistake of confusing Einstein's physical relativity with moral and spiritual relativity. Space and time are indeed relative, but truth is not. Indeed, if truth were relative, we could not truly say that space and time were relative. All right. So really rather just a kind of extrapolation on the points that Pascal is making. Let's go back to 125. We'll finish out this paragraph, and then I'll pause and see if you have... we'll get the commentary, I guess, and then we'll pause and see if you have anything you'd like to add. Okay, top of 125. This is our natural state, and yet the state most contrary to our inclinations. We burn with desire to find a firm footing, an ultimate lasting base on which to build a tower rising up to infinity. But our whole foundation cracks and the earth opens up into the depths of the abyss. All right, we'll go grab S and T. That's page 134. And then we'll pause to see if you want to say anything. Okay, 134, here are two facts. Two pieces of crucial data, both are equally solid. First, that no thing in this universe is solid, stable, absolute, and unchanging. Least of all, ourselves. Second, that we scream for that solidity. So this is an interesting thing to consider, that constant and perpetual change strikes us as at best an annoyance, but at worst a kind of hell where everything is constantly moving and shifting and changing. And what this probably is it's not that change itself is bad, it's just that on account of the fall in alienation to God, we've lost our grounding, and so you have nothing but change. Instead of a grounding which gives you that sense of inner peace and rest and security, by which then all other change can be received relative to that and can be enjoyed. But if you don't have that ground, if you've cut rope from God, then you're just tossing back and forth on the sea, and it's just constant change, and that is experienced in a kind of hellish way. Okay, so just can carry on here with the second idea here of Kraft about three lines in. Second, that we scream for that solidity. We yearn, we demand, we act like babies deprived of milk, fish of water, birds of air. We act like land creatures sucked from their home by a tidal wave in a past so remote and forgotten that we seem to have been drifting always. But all driftwood originally came from a tree with roots. The deep inner wisdom of our inclinations, our innate desire for eternity and absoluteness, leads us back to God, our true home, the fixed point of the turning world. Pascal's apologetic strategy is a long footnote to Augustine's restless heart. Okay, let's hit T real quick. All our towers of Babel fall because they are erected not on the foundation of the rock, but on our restless shifting sands, our relative earth and our understanding of it, our science. It is the Babel story repeated. There the tower fell because God confused its builder's language. To the ancients, language was identified with thought. A concept was an unspoken word. So the foundation was human knowledge, reason, science. This is the foundation of all human towers of Babel, including anti-intellectual ones. We must know even to scorn knowledge. That is why they all fall like sandcastles. What is the alternative? There is indeed a rock, and it is not knowledge. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Knowledge of Him and of ourselves comes from obedience, from love. If our will is to do His will, we will understand His teaching, not otherwise. All right, so there is Kraft already giving an answer to the conundrum set before us by Pascal and anticipating Pascal's own answer as it develops. Okay, any thoughts you have, anything you'd like to share or ask regarding what we've touched on so far? A couple different hands.
Just on a personal story of mine, of my life, basically, I was never allowed to live in any certain place for any length of time. I was a kid that had to follow their parents, moving. I finally got to stay 4 years in one place when I got to USC, when they welcomed me a year early from high school in their honors program. That was the first time I got to stay anywhere for 4 years or longer, which was an incredible amount of time. So I'm very familiar with shifting sands, and I was shifting ways that people act in different places in the United States. I was pretty much always in the United States, and customs and ways of being. And it's taken me a long time to claim that as actually a strength at this point, because it taught me to look, to observe, to really figure people out, to figure out how to fit in. It was an incredible experience. But I can say from firsthand experience, too, the only thing that really got me through it was my faith in God. And now as an older, wiser person, I look at that and I go, He knows what he's doing, and he's doing the shaping and the molding. And like a rose has to be pruned to be healthy. And I may not like what happens, what I've lost, what I have to change and adapt to, but it's taught me to be able to pivot, to, you know, to be able to do these things, but only through Christ, only through God, because I realize who's in charge anyway. I say this to my husband all the time. Well, who's really in charge over this one?
Yeah.
And when you recognize that, that is your only stability, because the world around you changes so often. You know, even my family now, they've all died before me. I'm the last of my family.
Yeah.
So my tribe that I traveled with is gone.
Yeah, that's the importance of being grounded in God. And the only alternative is to kind of be temporarily deluded and just, oh, you know, this is, it's like, oh, everything's going great, I'll just stay on the merry-go-round. But it's like, only when you look and see, like, is the merry-go-round still tethered to the earth? That's the, you know, that's the question.
The phrase I always use is, yeah, the shoe's going to drop.
Yeah, sure.
You're always waiting for that other, you know, the wheels always come off. My husband usually say that.
Yeah.
Too. When everything's going great, well, the wheel will come off.
Yeah.
You know, your kids are doing great, and all of a sudden somebody isn't.
Right. And then you compound all of that with the own shifting nature of your own mood or personality or abilities over the course of your life, which, you know, as we already heard, I think Pascal saying, is something like a normal curve, right? Where you come into the world with very little, you sort of peak somehow, somewhere, and before you even know it, you're starting to kind of go on the other downhill slide, and then you're sort of in this state of diminished capability in one way, shape, or form. So that adds infinite complexity to an already infinitely complex and changing world, your own changing internal variables. So the only way to survive this is either God or to be self-deluded. And many people are self-deluded. I mean, this is really kind of the root and grounding of a sort of anomia or lawlessness, because you just go, everything changed, nothing matters, all that matters is, and then you get this pseudo-wisdom, live in the moment, you know. Because this moment's here and then gone. So then the pseudo-wisdom is all you can do is just embrace what little constancy there is in the perpetual change. And effectively, it just becomes a kind of hedonism of living for the maximization of pleasure on one level or another. So, yeah, thank you for those reflections. And the only way to gain sanity or peace or groundedness is the way back to God and to return to Him. That's like the comment about Augustine's restlessness and Pascal's pensée craved.
And sadly, I've grabbed the other half of that, too, where my first husband, who was a father of our four children, I had hoped if I speak grave, we're not moving again. That's it. I wanted to provide them with stability. That's when I realized it really began to hurt. I mean, I was a huge body president. I just came up in prison.
Yeah.
It was always a loss of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, in many respects, you can see that like stoicism develops out of this, and the idea of control what you can control, but if you can't control it, then stop stressing about it. And that aspect of stoicism really probably has its root, even if unconsciously, in this idea that, because otherwise you can devolve into what's the point of wisdom if the wisest plans are easily thwarted by mere chance or mere foolishness or the fluttering of a butterfly's wings. So you can see that stoicism is an answer to that. It's an imperfect answer, obviously, but it's just this retreat into yourself, controlling what you can control and embracing the rest without passion, right?
Yeah, I think for me, well, it's not controlling so much, although maybe it's controlling the hurt. I become more comfortable with myself and fine being isolated and alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I want that, but
yeah.
I'm tired of finding it too, my way in.
Yeah, and I think to some degree that's an overlapping Venn diagram with monasticism purely sought, not especially the isolated monasticism that first arose where people would go out into the desert to live in solitude. It's a sense in which you recognize the chaos of the world, that even within the organized structures of the world, let's say government or societal institutions, it's just further, like no one's driving the ship. Maybe a few people think they're driving the ship, but no one in fact is. And so there's a sense of retreating away from that greater chaos and foolishness and delusion into oneself. But even there, the problem can't be avoided, right? Because you're changing yourself. Okay, any other thoughts? All right, let's jump back in on page 125. So here we're on the second full paragraph. Once that is clearly understood, I think that each of us can stay quietly in the state in which nature has placed him, since the middle station allotted to us is always far from the extremes. What does it matter if someone else has a slightly better understanding of things? If he has, and if he takes them a little further, is he not still infinitely remote from the goal? Is not our span of life equally infinitesimal in eternity, even if it is extended by 10 years? Yeah, you can get a lot of mileage out of that reflection in a lot of different ways. If we jump over to page 134, we'll just grab the first part of Crave's comment here. How much of our civilization's restlessness, this is you, and progressivism comes from our inability to be quiet and happy at home and mind our own business? All of it, according to Pascal. Okay, so there's a reflection on this paragraph on 125 that really is multifaceted. We could spend another 20 minutes just contemplating certain conclusions we might draw. Let's jump back into the text on 125. Starting with the paragraph, if man studied himself. If man studied himself, he would see how incapable he is of going further. How could a part possibly know the whole? But perhaps he will aspire to know at least the parts to which he bears some proportion. But the parts of the world are all so related and linked together that I think it is impossible to know one without the other and without the whole. And what makes our inability to know things absolute is that they are simple in themselves, while we are composed of two opposing natures of different kinds, soul and body. That is why nearly all philosophers confuse their ideas of things and speak spiritually of corporeal things and corporeally of spiritual ones. For they boldly assert that bodies tend to fall, that they aspire towards their center, that they flee from destruction, that they fear a void, that they have inclinations, sympathies, antipathies, all things pertaining only to things spiritual. And when they speak of minds, excuse me, they consider them as being in a place, and attribute to them movement from one place to another, which are things pertaining only to bodies. Instead of receiving ideas of these things in their purity, we color them with our qualities and stamp our own composite being on all the simple things we contemplate. Who would not think to see us compounding everything of mind and matter, that such a mixture is perfectly intelligible to us? Yet this is the thing we understand least. Man is to himself the greatest prodigy in nature, for he cannot conceive what body is, and still less what mind is, and least of all how a body can be joined to a mind. This is his supreme difficulty, and yet it is his very being. The way in which minds are attached to bodies is beyond man's understanding, and yet this is what man is. Okay, we'll go grab note W, and we can all breathe a breath that we finally made it through this pensée. So, page 135, comment W, Pascal seems to accept Descartes' mind-body dualism here, and in point 15, if we do this, we are as alienated from our own being as from nature. We are, in fact, no longer nature at all, only spirit plus artifice, ghost plus machine, an angel in a box. But Pascal, like a French cook, can use even this rotten spice in his cooking. He concludes from it that we cannot understand or master ourselves any more than nature. Know thyself is an unsolvable cone. And I recall that he brought this up before. Yes, a cone is a Japanese paradoxical anecdote. For example, what is the sound of one hand clapping? All right, so that's what a cone is. Okay, so what is the overall argumentation to grossly oversimplify? The whole of the Enlightenment is the assumption that man knows himself, and thus, since he knows himself as an objective instrument, he can know the world objectively. In final analysis, neither is true. It's completely failed metaphysically and even experientially, anecdotally, as we see that that's simply not true, that if man improves in one area, he seems proportionately to get worse in another area. And so for all the quote-unquote technological advancements that man has achieved through the quote-unquote Enlightenment, he's become proportionately spiritually diminished. Okay, let's see if you have any thoughts. Yeah, here's one just in front of you there.
So I was listening to this really interesting thing yesterday. It was
Alex O'Connor and this guy, Glenn Scrivener. Anyway, really great talk. They were talking a lot about the idea that the Enlightenment and a lot of Western thought, in fact, all of Western thought, comes from Christianity. And that all of the goodness that comes from that is either a common grace or from Christianity itself. And it seems to me that you're arguing, at least from Pascal's point of view, that the Enlightenment does not promote goodness in a Christian sense, and that instead it is promoting some irrational idea separate from God. Would you say maybe it's a result of it, but then also an accretion from it? So it's like the result of Christian thought, but then it also steers away from it because it lacks God? Or what's the, how does that mesh? How do we say that, like, these good things came from God, and then also that the steering away has led us further from it?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's like an apostasy that's very rational is based on the foundations of thought bequeathed by Christianity. So in that sense, it's almost a kind of heresy. When you're thinking about the Enlightenment worldview standing on the shoulders of Western Christendom and Western Christian philosophy, and then, like, sort of sitting on that branch of that tree, then seeking to saw through the trunk. That's about the Enlightenment project. So you can see then continuity and radical discontinuity. You can see how it certainly builds from and comes forth from the sort of Western Christian philosophical milieu, but then undercuts it and destroys it. And again, the idea here lost in the cosmos is that, I mean, man once upon a time was not nearly so lost in the cosmos as he is today. And if you say what changed, you kind of end up pointing back to the Enlightenment, to Bacon, to scientism, to materialism, maybe even to a certain degree, skepticism that comes out of this. I mean, there's at this level of epistemology, there's something deeply spiritual going on, because the claim to know absolute certainty is fundamentally the claim to be God. And so if that assertion is like the goal, that we can know absolute certainty in and of ourselves, then we no longer need God. You leave him in the rearview mirror, whether you're witting or unwitting, right? You leave him in the rearview mirror as soon as you can assert that. So I suppose that's another angle on what Pascal and Kraft are doing, is they're creating that silence, but you could also say here that silence consists of humility, that man would lose his hubris and his inflated sense of himself and his knowledge of himself and his knowledge of the world. And like from our modern vantage point, you'd have to say like, okay, you built a rocket ship and a cell phone, congratulations, we live in dust and ashes of spiritual poverty. Right? That'd be the kind of critique.
Sorry, one last note. I think that this summarizes it really well. He says in the Ponce, I'll just paraphrase it instead, that no amount of knowledge really makes a dent on the infinite goal, you know? You can't, just because somebody else is closer to the goal than you are, doesn't mean that they're any closer to the infinite than you are, you know? The infinite goal is still infinitude, so.
Right, yeah. And you can see how, I mean, just take it a little different direction, because I'm a pastor and I care about souls, you can see how people deal with this in unhealthy ways. Some mistake God as purely a matter of knowledge and this quest for knowledge. And they never rest in the fact that of the knowing of God, the pursuit will never cease. At some point, you have to rest in him, even as you retain what he's given. Other people, you know, they'll come to a crisis in their knowledge of God and they'll stop, or they'll think it's intractable, or they'll give up. And it's like, that's not the way either. I mean, there's always God is teaching something, whether in positive knowledge or even whether in the humiliation of hitting a dead end. Then there are also people who you'll kind of see this distortion. They go with the premise, since the knowledge of God is infinite and it doesn't matter whether we attain little or much, because relatively speaking, it's all little, then the knowledge of God isn't what's important, just loving your neighbor is, or something like that. And so then you get this kind of critique, you get this positive Christianity put forward, that it's not about not knowing God, it's about doing good stuff, or it's about loving people, and that's all it devolves into. So these are all kinds of distortions, and already in my mind are popping in another three or four, but I'll stop. The point would be to realize our grounding in God, to realize our identity in him, and then to pursue all these other aspects relative to that. So to know what you can know, to, for the praise and glory and enjoyment of God himself, but also then to love and to serve, even as we ourselves are loved and served. But we're being called there to a balance and a harmony. We're being called to embrace what he creates us to be as these quote-unquote middling creatures who are capable of great knowledge, and yet relatively it's nothing, capable of great love, and yet relatively it's nothing, but to embrace these things and pursue them with that kind of anchoring of the soul to God. I can't remember who used this terminology. I found it in like a Death on a Friday Afternoon by John Newman, but I can't remember if he quotes it from someone, but he calls the cross of Jesus the axis mundi, the axis upon which the world spins, the one point of stability around which, and I think that's a beautiful vision of Christianity, because in the cross you have the wisdom of God, but also the power of God. You have faith and you have love, and these things are the stable core around which we change and have our turning, but our eyes, as it were, are ever turned inward to that axis of the world, to Christ crucified and God's love expressed therein. Yes, sir.
Thank you. The one thing I've noticed that after being 75 years old is the constant grinding of this tension is part of the aging process, because you can't, it grinds you so hard in sometimes that, and you, the older you get, the less you can tolerate it. It's part of getting older, and part of the dying process and shedding this, whatever it is that causes the tension. In these areas, it's just interesting to me that going through it.
Yeah. It's a life is a trip, and the weird symmetry. You know, while we always desire that stability and certainty, it probably is most obvious at either end of the life cycle.
Yeah.
Right. You have little babies and little kids just like hate change, period. They love routines. You break the routine and like something's off. They can't articulate it. You've probably seen, I don't know why my daughter loves these, like the little YouTube clips of dads who have little babies that have always, the little babies have always known them with beards, and then they shave off their beard and do this reveal, and the babies all freak out. It's like this idea, I mean, that kind of just puts concretely this dislike of change and the uncertainty it causes at an innate level. And of course, as we grow up, we still experience this and feel this. We try to mitigate it. I mean, this is the way we try to mitigate it. You try to get your bank account. You try to get your family. You try to get your financial grounding. You try to get your people. You try to hold that little core together. But inevitably, you find it's what Jesus calls shifting sand. And so he has us build upon the rock that he is, so that even if all that other nonsense goes away, you're still grounded against the storm, right?
The other thing is anybody that's under 30 can hardly wait to get older, and anybody who's over 30 looks back and wishes they were younger.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great one. That's a great one. Every man wants responsibility until he has it, and then he doesn't want it. Yeah.
My coffee cup at home says, I hate change.
It's the one thing that doesn't change, huh? All right, any other thoughts, any other reflections? Okay, we'll jump into a fresh pensée. Page 135. Very bottom is pensée 201. And it appears that this one is short with quite a bit of commentary. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces fills me with dread. Yeah, so that's the other, I mean, it's kind of, as you consider different kinds of infinity or different kinds of finitude, different kinds of vastness or smallness, when you start contemplating, I mean, and this isn't like it's anything special, little kids can even do this. You start contemplating God's timelessness, that there never was a before for God, and you know, these kind of, and it's like, I mean, it can kind of feel like almost analogous to a roller coaster or something. I mean, you get this visceral, and then, and almost then like a vertigo, and then almost then like a terror and a horror, and your mind gropes and grasps for answers. I mean, this is kind of like what the modern mind is doing with the multiverse, and just all of the, like, it's trying to grope and grasp for answers to this kind of terror. It's trying to fill in the empty spaces that we are left with in truth, because we can comprehend just enough to know we can't comprehend what lies behind. Okay, so in any case, just trying to give a little flesh on that bone, the eternal silence of these infinite spaces fills me with dread. And there is a way, too, I mean, sorry to keep riffing on this, I guess, but there is a way, too, that when you consider, like, I think very often as Lutherans, as Western Christians, when we consider things like the fear of the Lord, we have in mind, like, his wrath over moral failings or something like that. But there's a different kind of fear altogether that Pascal's getting at, and that's just within the nature of God himself as you contemplate. There's a kind of holy awe and terror one feels when you kind of recognize that even the things that you might predicate about God, you don't really have a grounding for or an understanding of. And it's just like ever receding mystery, and that is a kind of again, now this does is probably the cause of or the effect of sin, I mean, that it creates a sort of terror within us instead of just pure awe and wonder and humility. There comes along with it a sense of terror and this kind of dread, and we even have a strange kind of dread of, like, I mean, this is really the innate desire to say that salvation is dependent upon something in us, because it's horrifying in a sense to think that if God decides otherwise, there's nothing you can do. So there's this kind of terror at that level as well, and then this bad theology that rushes into the void. I mean, the real proper biblical way of thinking about this is really the judo flip on that whole temptation, and that's to say, well, I trust God better, more than I trust myself. And I trust that even though he is infinite and unknowable to me, I nonetheless would not exist without him, and am fully indebted and entrusted to him. And then to realize that there's no safer place to be. How do you know that? Well, you know that because of the cross. That's how the cross connects so deeply. Or how do you know that about the Father? By looking at the Son. Only in knowing the Son can you know the Father. Only through knowing the knowable, which is Christ, do you grasp the unknowable, and whether or not, like, you should be filled with unbridled terror, or whether you should be filled with filial fear, the fear of a son. So you can see then at this level how the cross and how Jesus himself, and I this isn't Lutheran theology per se. I mean, Lutherans say all of this stuff, but this is right out of the scriptures. I mean, this is John's prologue, where Christ is the exegete of the unknowable Father. This is Paul's. He is the express image of the invisible God. He is the knowledge of the one who is unknowable. And so on and so forth. So the whole gospel, what I'm trying to say is the whole gospel at ground level in the apostolic scriptures is addressing this question, this issue. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces fills me with dread. Okay, should we go on to Crafe's commentary, or anyone want to add any thoughts or reflections there on that quick but deep pensée? Okay, let's just jump in with Kraft. This minuscule pensée contains within it a cosmic earthquake, It manifests a radically new relationship between man and nature, one that sets off the mind of modern Western civilization from every other civilization in history, and it is about something that is omnipresent and all-embracing. The usual way of describing this change is to say that scientific knowledge of nature and technological control of it have progressed enormously, that man now has a radically greater knowledge of nature. This is exactly the opposite of the truth. Our knowledge of nature has shrunk, for nature now appears empty, purposeless, meaningless. This is a minus, not a plus. If the old meanings that every pre-modern civilization saw in nature were really there, then modernity is not demythologized, but orphaned, delivered not from superstition, but from home. So, I mean, you can wrap your mind around this any number of ways, but if you take, let's say, the phenomenon of lightning, and the ancient world, and maybe many parts of the world today that aren't modern, might think, oh, this is divine activity. This is the gods. And then they would see if a lightning comes and strikes a field and it creates a fire and damages the harvest, they would say, this is the wrath of God or the gods or whatever. That's far closer to the truth than what we have today, which is, oh, lightning just happens by chance. It's a phenomenon of weather, which happens by chance in a universe in which there's no God. And so if lightning falls from the sky and strikes the hills and burns down the city in which is your home, well, that was just chance. That was just the accident of nature.
Global warming.
Yeah. Right. So if you took those two views of the world, who's closer to the truth, the pagan or the modern American materialist? And that's precisely the point that Kraft is making here, is that our understanding of reality is not a plus, but a minus. It's not grown, but it shrunk. And I mean, this is, I think I was talking with the men's study on Monday night about this, because Luther just flat out says that those things we call natural disasters are sent by God as punishments for not keeping the commandments. And you look at modern pastors, and anytime there's some sort of disaster, they're like the first ones to announce to everyone that this is definitively not the wrath of God, and these things just happen. And so it never gives anyone any opportunity to actually repent or fear the Lord or connect what happens in nature to the Lord. And so in a sense, they've inoculated people against the entire book of the natural revelation of God. So you can see how upside down and diminished even the church and theologians and Christianity, I mean, not properly speaking, of course, but as these things exist, how weak it's all become. Okay, so that's a fascinating insight and a challenging thesis that the old quote-unquote superstitious people actually knew more about the nature of the universe than we moderns do. Let's jump into that next paragraph. No pre-modern writer ever used the word space as Pascal does here and as we all do today. What we call space, the ancients and medievals called the heavens. The linguistic change is not accidental. The whole cosmos has been emptied. An emptiness word, space, has replaced a fullness word, heavens. And it's interesting to contemplate how far you could push this as we try to sort of remythologize, or rather understand the universe as it properly is, rather than through this ridiculously limiting scientism worldview that we've been bequeathed. So one of the things that the ancients considered is that the heavenly bodies, and I mean, very frankly, they identified the heavenly bodies with gods or angelic beings, as we might call them today. So that was universal. So the idea is you would look up and you would see the principalities and powers. Now, even if we don't identify those creatures of God, stars, planets, what have you, with angelic beings, it's nonetheless quite possible to see these as physical representations or physical things under the control of small g gods or angelic beings. And in some respects, the Bible actually seems to speak to that, to speak in that way and to speak that language, telling us as God's people not to worship those beings, not to worship the stars and heavenly bodies. What's fascinating is he doesn't say because it's not true, but rather because they're not the one true God. So it's a very interesting question. I think this is kind of one of the exciting reformations, if you'll pardon a little probably inappropriate use of the word, but one of the reformations going on, I think, in Christianity right now is a recognition of how much we've lost on account of science and materialism, and how much there is to regain, and how even our modern understanding of physical things isn't contradictory to those things that are outright stated in the Bible. You know, many things that we've just dismissed is, well, that's how stupid people used to look at the world. Now we realize that we're the stupid ones and quite impoverished, and those things that the Bible just takes at face value probably are and exist. And so now it's up to us to re-grasp that. Yes?
My father said something from the time I was little, and I'm sure all of you heard the same phrase, but when the thunder struck, he did a both in, or an in with an under. And he said, oh, those are angels bowling in heaven.
Yeah.
It was, and he set bowling pins as a kid as a little extra money making job for himself. So that was, I mean, but other people have heard of angels bowling in heaven with the thunder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like I've always had that juxtaposition. He pointed to the angels, not to worship them. But then through this modern bowling idea in too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Odd thing, but what you said about thunder just made me think of that right away.
Yeah, and when you re-mythologize, I'll probably have to define that at some point, the world, when you start to see it more just as the Bible teaches it and as your senses experience it, you start to trust yourself again instead of like doubting all of this. What you see is that not only do the heavens like kind of have this revelation, but then so does the earth. So we recognize at a sensory level, at an experiential level, that being on a mountaintop is very different than just being on a plane somewhere. That being in a place that's enshrouded by trees where you've got a crystalline river flowing through with various waterfalls, that's a completely different location than being on a freeway and bumper-to-bumper traffic. I mean, we recognize all of these things, but we, I think, immediately deny them because we think, well, we live in a material world. These things just happen. There's nothing particularly special about one place or another. Now, one step removed from that is that the same way that the ancients would look at the heavens and say, this is obviously indicating gods or the presence of gods, or maybe they are even saying these things are gods, they would look at the world and say, these are sacred spaces, or these are thin places, or these are spiritual places. And what you find is that even in the scriptures, there's a kind of acknowledgement that that's the way the world is built. Now, there's a recognition that we're to worship the one true God, but it seems to accept the premise, the scriptures themselves, I mean, the Holy Spirit himself, seems to acknowledge that not all places are the same. So materialism has not only stripped us of the heavens, but most likely of the earth, and of the understanding that there are sacred spaces and different spaces and liminal spaces. And if we believe in a kind of cosmic hierarchy that the Bible does, that extends all the way down upon the places of the earth. And so it really lends credence again to these things that we experience. I mean, sometimes you're in the woods and it's very pleasant. Sometimes you're in the woods and you're struck by this feeling of like being watched or a horror or a fear. We've been taught, oh, this is superstitious. Don't trust your own feelings or your own senses or your own intuition. We all know that this is just materialism, and it's no different here than it is anywhere else. And is that right? So maybe that'll be the cliffhanger for today. If we can say and assert all of these things, as Pascal and Krafft do about the heavens, might we not also recover what the ancients thought about the earth? So, leave you with that question, leave you with that thought. Next week, we'll pick back up on 136, and since we're out of the woods of that great big long one, I doubt we'll get this far, but in any case, feel free to read ahead and prep for 146. That's what I'll be doing, 136 to 146. That'll bring us to the end, not only of Lost in the Cosmos, but also to the end of the very short chapter on death. The Lord be with you.
Also with you.